Starting at birth, from our very earliest moments of existence, every one of us is continuously exposed to situations and sensations which require us to learn and adapt. Each experience generates a sequence of perception, reaction, and decision. Just like the land, which builds up in layers from volcanic deposits, alluvial silts, and organic decay, leaving areas of rocks and soil formed into the flat, sunken, or steep contours which tell a geological story to the trained observer, so our daily thoughts and choices are formed on the strata of an inner history, as specific to each of us as the familiar place where we grew up. Each moment of experience, whether stressful or happy, is recorded in the growing memory along with footnotes and evaluations which we then use as guides for future decisions. As we revisit the terrain of this inner landscape, it becomes a kind of reference map, which we use to make instant-to-instant decisions throughout the course of each new day's journey. Like some well-worn network of pathways through field and forest, our past decisions, whether accurate or not, become the tracks we tend to follow as a new future greets us every day. In itself, this internal habit map is neither good nor bad. Our ability to perform complex action is simplified by building up a groundwork of unconscious competency, which allows us to attend to all our regular tasks and activities without having to pay full attention to each move we make. We can walk and carry on a conversation at the same time because walking has become a practical habit of action that no longer requires our continuous attention. This ability to travel on the back of what we have learned is the factor that allows us to continue to evolve new and improved forms of culture. What we seldom realize, however, is how much these habits of thought also lead us to disadvantageous choices. In order to act effectively and in our true best interest, we need to be able to accurately assess any new opportunity. But because of the way our subconscious thought process is wired, we tend to interpret the new in terms of the past. Here's how it works. Let's say that a baby was raised in a household where there was a constant sense of financial stress, and that after each payday there was a short period of optimism, followed by a progressively darkening mood of worry and anxiety as expenses drained the available funds down to near crisis levels. Let's also say that in this particular family, the parents had a very loving relationship, and the challenge of surviving in spite of limited means appeared to bring them closer together. It's more than likely that this child will, based on their actual experience of their family and observation of their parents, draw the unconscious conclusion that a stable family is held in place by financial stress. This is a logical conclusion based on the evidence, but it is also wrong. If this belief remains unquestioned in the subconscious mind, that individual, that child, as they grow up, may tend to inadvertently avoid or subvert any long-term prosperity for fear of losing love. Now, I've seen this type of situation many, many times. The confusing outcome is that you'll have an individual who will be lucky in relationship but unlucky with money. You will have an individual who has the paradoxical tendency to feel secure when there's financial adversity, but who will become nervous and worried when things are going well. Then, driven from within to stay on their well-worn, time-tested, proven, and I say that in quotes, proven path, that person may repeatedly sabotage any enduring financial success even as they persistently attempt to achieve riches as a solution to their perpetual dilemma. You can see how this is a catch-22. If they think that financial stress leads to family security, then any time when they have too much money, they'll begin to feel that their family is threatened, so unconsciously they will get rid of or drain off that surplus money to return to a dynamic of stress in order to keep their family together. The subconscious mind is wired in these contradictory ways, and it's very difficult when that is something that you don't consciously see or sense in yourself to understand why these patterns keep repeating themselves over and over again. So we are indeed creatures of habit. We awaken each day to resume our accustomed identity, which is largely a set of habitual beliefs about who we are and what we can or cannot do. It's been estimated that our thoughts every day are about 70% the same as the thoughts we had the day before and the day before that. That's how we continue recognizing ourselves and knowing who we are and following our standard set chosen behavior patterns. But there's much more to us than those ingrained habits. And what we're talking about here is how to first become aware of those unconscious patterns and secondly, to begin to modify them. Now, if you're listening to this course, you're someone who is obviously open to change and who would consider rethinking some of these old beliefs. So my first suggestion is to consider all your beliefs as experimental. Then you'll be able to test some new ideas in order to see what happens. The trick is to remember that for every new experimentally chosen idea, there are often deep and contrary earlier assumptions of which you may not be fully aware. The results you've had in the past are the expression and outcome of the unconsciously held beliefs which I'm calling the inner landscape. That contour at the bottom of your mind where everything else that you try to do is based. It's like the foundation for your reality. Now, one of two things may happen as you listen to new ideas. Either you will find that your new goal will fail for reasons that seem to have to do with outer forces, not something from inside. It'll look like it's coming from the environment, as when, let's say, your newly increased income or salary is offset by a series of unexpected car expenses or medical expenses. Of course, this seems just like a coincidence that they happen to come just at the time when you've got this extra money sitting around. Or you may notice a rising tide of doubts spoken by voices inside your head, as well as by skeptical friends and family telling you why this new idea of yours can't work. In both cases, the unseen contours of the subconscious landscape will cause you to stumble in your attempt to get better results. You'll try to do new things, you'll do everything right, and yet the world will seem to be aligned against you and trip you up. So how does one look into that obscurity of the unconscious to make changes in the landscape of habitual beliefs? A reliable and gradual way is to change your external environment first. If you desire to change, spend more time around people who already embody those changes. As you become familiar with other points of view and begin to understand the evidence that supports those beliefs, the old unconscious pathways will begin to shift. If you're around people who are succeeding at the same thing that you are emulating or wanting to succeed in yourself, it will be easier for your subconscious to believe that it's possible. After a time, you might find that you're no longer going in circles and repeating the same patterns again and again. New inner thoughts will begin to produce new outer results. This is really a form of starting over, using the natural abilities of your intelligence to absorb and process useful information. Just as you did when you were a child. You learned by imitation then, without any effort. The more inspiring the model, the more we were eager to imitate it. Let's say you had a favorite uncle who did things a certain way, and you loved this person very much, you would take on those traits effortlessly just by natural imitation. Conversely, the more frightening or threatening the model, the quicker we are to conform to its conditioning. So if you had someone who was hostile or who frightened you or threatened you, you will tend to suppress your own feelings more rapidly as a way of avoiding that conflict. Now, if you desire positive change, increase positive influences and decrease negative elements in your mental environment as much as possible. This doesn't mean that you should pretend that things are better than they actually are. That kind of wishful thinking simply coats over problems of belief, rather than actually changing them. It's like having graffiti painted on the wall and just painting over it. It doesn't really remove those thoughts. They're just under a different veneer, a different surface. One has to really become quite a philosopher and find ways to look at the problems of life from a different angle, which will allow one to see these obstacles as steps towards a positive outcome. Instead of pretending that the obstacles aren't there or the problems aren't there, look at the problem as an opportunity for change so that you'll be able to bring up your old thoughts that actually have generated this resistance and change the way you look at the problem itself. The good news is that this is a self-reinforcing process. I often challenge people to try out positive thinking. Simply monitoring their thoughts and gradually replacing limiting assumptions with more expansive ideas. I tell them that they must give the experiment a real chance by staying with it for at least 90 days. Then, if they're not satisfied with the way things are changing, they can always return their positive ideas and get all their old limited thoughts back. But what invariably happens is that the sense of increased well-being is so apparent that it seems pure folly not to continue to think in this more confident way. It feels better, it works better, why go back to the negative and limiting thoughts? Sometimes, using new information will force old beliefs to become active even before they're consciously recognized. It's as if when you start to create new, fresh movement at the surface, it drives old material up from the bottom of the pond, and you don't know it until it appears as a result in your experience or your environment. For example, many of us have been conditioned to such deep-seated fear of a parent's anger that we're reluctant to challenge any form of authority at all. We've accepted a state of disempowerment as the safest way to go. Unfortunately, this too is a self-fulfilling fear. If we remain sheep, the wolves will continue to eat us. So I encourage you to consider the costs of accepting the limiting social beliefs which keep culture going down a road which leads to a desperate end. Our world is entirely shaped by family patterns which are influencing our financial decisions, our political decisions, the actions of our government and of our media. All of this is an expression of this inner landscape, this undertow, which actually prevents people from taking positive choices because they fear the unfamiliar. This is a very profound subject which goes far beyond simply recognizing the facts about the Federal Reserve Bank or the IRS which have been brought forward in this course. The real story of our modern distress begins with these topics, but leads much, much farther. Eventually, we will want to know why individuals much like ourselves can behave so badly as to perpetuate these dishonest systems. The underlying cause is always that people will do anything to conform to the contours of their inner landscape, the subconscious survival strategy laid down in childhood. Our leaders were once children, had parents, and formed a hidden system for controlling their world. Anyone or anything that threatens that must be stopped. Thus, many politicians are driven to public office by their own unconscious anxieties and inadequacies, by a need to either prove themselves or to control everyone who might disapprove of them. This is why Bill Clinton, for example, though certainly a very intelligent man, behaved so foolishly as to attract the most embarrassing public disapproval, and then was able to survive in office in spite of it. He was used to this type of pressure, he was used to this type of disapproval, and he drew it on himself in order to continue his unconscious survival plan. Now, I'm saying all this to give you the chance to seriously consider the options that have been presented to you in this course. If you take the time to check the claims and the facts that you've heard here, you may find that it becomes personally unacceptable to continue doing some of the things which seemed right before you learned the truth about how you've been educated, how you've been conditioned to choose a life strategy which does not ultimately support your best interests. Don't minimize the significance of what you're learning here. It does take a lot of courage, once you've recognized your choices, to change what used to seem like safe habits of social conduct vis-a-vis the establishment or the government. The primary barrier to change is fear. We fear the unknown. We tend to cling to known limitations rather than try something new which might lead towards freedom. Throughout history, we see example after example of innovators in science being burned at the stake or, if they're more fortunate, being simply ridiculed and discredited, only to have their ideas finally proven right years after their death. But let us also remember that there are always a substantial number of wrong ideas mixed in with the true and valuable ones, so it would be foolish to endorse all theories which are put forward simply because they're new. There's a big difference between indoctrination and education. Indoctrination puts doctrine into you. That's what the word literally means, indoctrination, to put doctrine in. While education, which comes from the Latin e, which means out of, ducare, which means to lead out, education leads you out of limited knowledge into greater awareness. It's the opposite of indoctrination. What we need to do is question the status quo and investigate new proposals, test them fairly to see if they'll stand. Like a rock climber traversing a cliff wall, it's better to establish a new secure pin for our rope before we untie ourselves from our previous position. Don't just leap based on hope. do as much research and testing to prove these ideas before you abandon the old ones and just shift into something that you think is going to work better. What was believed impossible in previous centuries is seen as commonplace and normal now. At one time, the world was known to be flat, and the sun and stars rotated across the sky on great transparent concentric shells. Any fool could see that this was true, and to question it was regarded as evil and dangerous. Beliefs become traditions that are passed on from one generation to the next unless a child is born who persists in asking questions and collecting evidence outside the prevailing belief system. So to be a good pathfinder and leader, one must have combined the skills of independent thinking, careful research, convincing demonstration, and a shrewd ability to assess the prevailing mindset and meet it halfway. One has to establish credibility before one makes a motion to change the rules. As my Chinese Tai Chi master once told me, if I've seen a ghost and you tell me that's impossible, that's foolish on your part. But if I say I've seen a ghost and I expect everyone to believe me, that's even more foolish. So the cultural diplomat will try to understand the motives that drive each side of an argument and mediate change starting from a point of agreement. This requires a certain psychological sophistication, and psychological insight is won only through honest and penetrating work on oneself first. Then, by extension, one can begin to empathize with and interpret the concerns of others. If you simply try to tell someone that they are wrong and you are right, you may end up missing your opportunity to be of use to them. As someone once said, when you go to negotiate with people wearing dark suits, don't wear red socks to the first meeting. This reminds us to establish a common link first, then from there to lead on towards new ground. But even this principle needs to be used strategically. Sometimes it might in fact work better to show up wearing those red socks. You have to use your intuitive judgment of the people that you're trying to communicate with to guess what would be the best way of making the energy move and change. Now, to get back to our discussion of fear, imagine, if you can, that you were born in a time when the world was flat. How would you feel if I turned up one day and told you that it was round and moved around the sun while spinning on its axis? And that this explained day and night and the changes of the seasons? How would you react, and what opinions would you form of me? Would you begin to open your mind to a new possibility? Then let's say that we continued to discuss and debate these questions, and that gradually you began to consider that I might be right and that everything you had previously believed might be wrong. How would you feel? And what would you need to do to allow yourself to change? Before the 15th century, it was a very real issue for European mariners that if they went too far from shore, they would probably reach the edge of the world, and they and their ship would be swept off the earth and fall into endless doom. The idea of a round earth both solved this problem and generated new fears. If one were to sail to the bottom of the spherical earth, might one not fall just as disastrously into space? Without the understanding of gravity around the surface of a sphere, which is a counterintuitive notion, it might seem even more dangerous to be on a round earth than on a flat one. Only after Magellan circumnavigated the globe did people finally begin to trust the round earth model. And it was not until the North and South Poles were physically reached several centuries later that the subconscious doubts of humanity were mostly settled. But even now, today, in spite of photographs taken from space, there are still groups of people who continue to insist that the Earth is flat. These ideas persist because they make sense from a certain point of view to people based on their experience of their own lives and their own style of rational thinking and considering new possibilities. What I'm saying is that it's challenging to accept new models because all our senses have been conditioned by our beliefs to interpret experience according to certain controls. We need to believe that it is safe to get out of bed in the morning if we're even going to live our lives. We need to have some kind of assumption about what can happen, and that has to be beneficial enough for us to go forward. We need to have a sense of possibility, or we would be so disheartened that we might just give up on living. Stuart Heller, author of The Dance of Becoming, has said, quote, "To believe is divine, but to believe your beliefs is stupid. An experimental belief allows us to act, but a fixed belief has become dogma and prevents us from considering new ideas. You have to hold your beliefs lightly. Try them out, see how they work, and always be ready to readjust, perfect, convert them in case new information comes to light. Now, you've listened to a great many assertions in this course, which might at first have seemed shocking to you. Your general beliefs, what you've been taught in school, what you've seen on television, have read in the papers, have heard from your friends and family, the, quote, facts about history and current events, have largely been called into question. Now it's up to you to study the points and arguments presented by our speakers and to check and prove them for yourself. But please be observant of your doubts and fears. Those fears are the clues which will connect you to your subconscious and help you see the contours of your inner landscape, that prejudicial program which has been determining the outcome of your efforts in life. As you engage yourself with those fears, concerns, anxieties, vague feelings of doubt, and other emotional and physical sensations, know that you are in that very moment changing the shape of things inside. Whenever we experience an emotion while continuing to breathe, relax, and move forward, that old pattern is transmuted into a form that is congruent with our new knowledge and new experimental belief. What each of us must do is remove the contradiction between our conscious thoughts and our unconscious fears. It is this very change that then permits new realities to form and allows them to be perceived by others as well. If you had never seen anyone ride a bicycle, and then were shown one and told that you could ride it, would you believe that you were being told the truth? It's counterinstinctive to expect a two-wheeled vehicle to be able to balance. But if you see someone else demonstrating that it can be done, you might be more willing to risk it. The bicycle became a reality only in the late 19th century. The horseless carriage or automobile followed soon after. The word automobile means automobile, something that moves by itself, no horse in front. It was a radically new idea for people to understand and trust. At first, both contraptions, the bicycle and the car, were really only for daredevils. But now that fear has been dispersed, and we can fly in airplanes at 40,000 feet while calmly reading a magazine, or at least most of us can. What you've been learning in this course corrects many false ideas about history, money, banking, taxes, the media, and gives you tools to teach yourself to restore your natural political freedoms and personal rights. The method of producing real change in your life is consistent with what I've been saying. First, expose your mind to these new ideas while noticing the old habits of belief. Think and breathe your way through these old considerations as you examine and review them. Keep what makes sense and let go of what is no longer correct. Seek out people who embody the new principles in their daily lives. Stop trying to convince your friends and family to change, because this is really just a covert way of trying to convince yourself. Instead, go ahead, change your own life first, with the support of groups of positive friends, and then invite your old acquaintances to visit your new reality after it has become a success. Then your results will do the convincing for you. As you listen again to the stories of the people in this course, you will hear and notice that they all went through this process of inner change as they researched and uncovered the truth about the issues that concerned them. They all encountered challenges. You have the advantage of their experience in starting your own quest. As more and more people confirm these discoveries, society will gradually change its beliefs, and we may soon be able to live our lives in the responsible freedom envisaged by the framers of the Constitution, without fear of attack from short-sighted interests or interference from a government that has forgotten its mandate to represent us. We will continue to add to this course periodically in order to keep you informed with the best information we can find. We thank all who have contributed to this first supplement, and we thank you for your willingness to think about and use what you have heard.